I'm Alan Morris. I'm the CEO of the Jewish Guild for the Blind in New York, and we are both a provider and an insurer. I've been told I'm not supposed to say that because we do run a managed care program that's Medicaid capitated, and beginning in January will be Medicare capitated as well for visually impaired elders with numerous comorbidities who are at risk for nursing home placement, all of whom qualify for being in nursing homes under both New York and federal standards. By way of background, this is an area that we've been working in for a while, and Elizabeth, I think, is the only person in the audience who's seen some of these things before, but it's important for you to note that blindness is a major disability, and of the U.S. population, there are about 2.5% currently who have either legal blindness or low vision, trending up to about 3.5% or 3.6% by 2020. Those numbers are probably not real good because the data on blindness, as most of you know, is really quite disappointing. What we're interested really is in at the Guild in doing is understanding the use of healthcare resources by people who are blind and visually impaired, and understanding how that's different from how other people use resources. And our underlying theme is both that blind people use resources differently and the cost of the resources they use has differential impact. In a study that we published in Archives of Ophthalmology in 99 using data from 96, so we're now talking about 10-year-old data, and you'll see that it's that old when you see the slide I'm going to put on next. We looked at how vision impairment contributes to length of stay in New York hospitals. New York has a very unique database called SPARCS, which looks at the data based on discharge of all discharges from all New York hospitals, and it's a very rich source of data. And what we were interested in was whether there was a difference in length of stay across DRGs between people with vision loss as compared to those who don't have vision loss. And point out three pieces of data on this. First is the difference was 2.4 days after multivariate adjustment. Very, very significant in terms both of resource use as well, obviously, as cost. The second thing is the small number, 5739, of patients with vision impairment or discharges with vision impairment compared to the 1,960,000. That 5739 can't possibly be right based on the demographics of New York, but the coding in New York hospitals doesn't routinely code vision loss, and that's an ongoing problem that we have. And the third piece to look at is the length of stay, and I don't know what the length of stay is running now, but my guess is it's probably running on average 4 or 5 days less than that. So we would expect that difference to go down, but my guess is it's probably still there proportionally. So we have a very significant difference in use of hospital resources, and in looking at some of the reasons behind this in the paper that we did previously, we found some very bizarre kinds of things. For example, nurses would leave catheters in substantially longer in patients with vision loss. They wouldn't let them get out of bed as quick because they didn't want them to screw up their surgery by falling or bumping into something. They'd leave the catheter indwelling, they'd get an infection. Infection would result in excess hospitalization, et cetera, et cetera. So if we move from days to dollars and project the excess days, you can see that the difference is very substantial. And I think it's important to understand we're truly talking about excess days. We're not talking about anything to suggest that blind people or even sighted people should be discharged before they're ready. But once they're ready to be discharged, once there's no discernible medical reason, those truly are excess days. So when we look at vision as a comorbidity, it contributes obviously very significantly to falls among females particularly. It's been associated with all-cause mortality, and it's a very, very serious healthcare problem that generally is not well addressed by the healthcare system. So in general, our premise is that it's been understudied, and with apologies to Dr. Spencer, we don't have access on here, but obviously the four things that we should be looking at when we're looking at vision and healthcare is access, delivery, utilization, and cost. And I think those things all obviously interact and are important to consider together. So in this study, what we tried to look at was whether the, and it gets fairly arcane, but whether the current Medicare reimbursement methodology properly estimates and reimburses healthcare costs incurred by patients with vision loss. And Medicare is obviously a major driver of our healthcare system. Much of what happens in non-Medicare populations is still very dependent on policies that, that the federal government and the state set based on Medicare. The sample we used is a somewhat interesting data set that we got from a public use data set from the National PACE Association. Do you know what PACE is? PACE is a program of all-inclusive care for the elderly, originally developed in California. ONLOC was the original site. It was made permanent in, it was a demonstration project for about 20 years and made permanent in the last decade. PACE takes care of people who are Medicare and Medicaid eligible, who are frail elderly, and the difference between a PACE model and the model that we use at the Guild is the PACE model is largely prescribed in statute and regulation and is very restrictive. The PACE model, in its original conceptualization, required that people attend a PACE site, and the PACE site had doctors, nurses, all kinds of health professionals in one place, and it required that they show up on a very stringent and periodic basis and get their health care with and through the PACE providers. They've since loosened that up somewhat to enlarge the model, but to give you some idea of the size, ONLOC is well under 2,000 people. The largest PACE program in the country is in New York at Beth Abraham, CCM, and they have, I think, 2,200, and they've been in business about 25 years. We started our program, which takes care of the same population, 7 years ago, and we have 7,000 people. So we have more people in our program than probably the six largest PACE programs in the country put together at this point. They're, as I said, they're all Medicare eligible, and most importantly, they all meet federal requirements for qualifying for nursing home placement. So these are people who are residing in the community but wish to remain in their own homes and can be maintained in their own homes or communities with some extraordinary kinds of supports. The definition of vision loss that we were compelled to use is the definition that PACE uses, and it's a very, very, very restrictive definition. Cannot see at all, or sees some lighter shadows, but not obstacles in path. So we impute from that that people who meet the PACE definition as having vision loss are at the least legally blind, and probably way, way, way beyond that. There is no way in that data set to parse that data and come up with better definitions. And we're disappointed in that, but we were compelled to use a definition. HCCs are hierarchical category conditions, which is Medicare's attempt to eliminate gaming in the reimbursement system by automatically forcing reimbursement up based on the configuration of diagnoses that a patient has. Under the DRG system, it makes a difference whether you have COPD with asthma or whether you're admitted with asthma and have a comorbidity of COPD. What HCCs attempt to do is to eliminate that kind of gaming, because we all of us who work in healthcare institutions have people on our staff who are very skilled at figuring out what the primary admitting diagnosis ought to be. So you have somebody who's obviously in the middle of an asthma attack, and the nurse is saying it's very clear they have COPD, because that will pay more. What HCCs do is it takes that out and forces you into a federally determined reimbursement structure. And the risk-adjusted model that they have is available on their website, and I'm going to make absolutely no attempt to explain it or go through it. It's beyond me. This table, unfortunately, has some errors towards the bottom. The errors are not in the numbers, but in the way that the data are grouped. If we look at the, and I wish I had a, you don't have a, yeah. There we go. All enrollees, fairly large number. Relative risk, obviously, is one. Those with vision impairment, not bad in terms of overall number, but you can see, again, when you're talking about people 55 and older, it's unlikely there are as few as 107 with vision loss, and the relative risk goes up by about 10% over those who are not visually impaired. That's the total population. of special significance to us, and what we're really concerned about are the people who look like our population. So when we look at visually impaired, non-institutionalized people, that means they're living in the community, because one thing I didn't tell you was both in our program and in PACE, people aren't dropped from the program when they actually are admitted to nursing home. So we actually have members who we're paying for who reside in nursing home. We want to get them out, obviously, and the reason we're not allowed to drop them as members is because the feds and the state want us to have that incentive to get them out, which is a good thing. But so when we look at the visually impaired non-institutionalized, relative risk goes up to 1.13, and that should be compared with the non-vision impaired non-institutionalized of 1.004. So it's about 13% greater. When we look at the visually impaired institutionalized compared to the non-visually impaired institutionalized, they're really close. And the reason that the non-visually impaired non-institutionalized are so much higher, and here we're talking about healthcare costs, is because once you're in an institution, once you're an inpatient in a nursing home, your care needs are fairly stable. What these comorbidities don't become additive, and they don't add anything else to your care. When you're in the community, they do. So there's a fairly significant difference. So what we found was that among PACE members residing in institutions, vision loss really didn't affect their care very much, but very significantly for those requiring health care residing in the community, there's a very, very sharp rise in their costs. So our conclusion that we suggest cautiously, and cautiously for the limitations I'll give you on the next slide, is that the HCC methodology under-reimburses hospital stay for visually impaired patients because it fails to recognize the risk for excess cost, most probably accounted for substantially by length of stay. Nothing special happens with visually impaired people in the hospital. So they're not doing more medical procedures, more labs, more tests. They're just keeping them. And it's that excess length of stay that's driving up the cost, not additional care needs. A person with COPD, with vision loss and without vision loss, is a person with COPD. There is no special interaction between those two. Limitations that we really have to pay careful attention to are the small numbers of patients in PACE who met their very restrictive definition. If we started to generalize, and we didn't want to do that, into the larger population of PACE, that 1.13 would come down. The ICD-9 codes for vision loss are frequently excluded on the HCFA 1500 form. That's the form that's used for claims. That's the basis for claims in Medicare. And it allows, I don't remember the number of positions it has, but it allows an awful lot of data to be put in. Physicians and other providers of healthcare rarely bother to code vision unless it has a direct impact on their reimbursement. They have no incentive to do it unless that comorbidity is going to drive up their reimbursement. So relying strictly on HCFA 1500s as a data source, which is what we have when we're looking at claims data, is very, very questionable. But it is the only data that are generally available. What we're doing going forward is we're looking at a much, much larger data sample, the Medicare 5% data set, and we're analyzing it by risk score band, which is, that HCC risk score to further explore the impact of vision loss and healthcare costs, and to give you a peek at what we intend to present next year. Going across, if you look at the costs, and you can see that with patients who have, really minimal risk, the cost might be as little as $616 on a per member per month basis, rising up to $2,413 for those with a 2-plus risk. Across all of these, the difference between, if you look at the revenue compared to the claim, until you get all the way out on those who are over here, the revenue falls short in every single risk band. So regardless of and this is not done by degree of vision loss, it's done by degree of overall morbidity. But if you have vision loss, regardless of what else you have, until you get out to very, 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 a 2-plus is a very, very high number, Medicare is going to under-reimburse. We're going to experience this directly in January. And when I spoke with CMS, when we had our discussions about where we're going and what our rate ought to be, they agreed with our data and they agreed with our analysis, but said they had no way to recognize it. So what they implored us to do was to trust them, I'm a good American and I follow our government, and I did, and I said, I'll trust you, and they said, trust us, we will, once we have our hands on your data, which we wouldn't give them unless they gave us a rate that we found to be adequate, and we ended up with a risk score of about 1.8. So we're just on the fringe of this 2.0, but a little bit on the short side of it. So we feel we're going to be under-reimbursed by, maybe 20-25%, and that translates for us into tens of millions of dollars a year, potentially. And they said, once we have our hands on your data, if we agree with your conclusions then, we will find a way going forward to adjust. And because we are who we are, we said, sure. Because if we didn't, once again, this population would get excluded from the program because no one else is taking care of them. So the population that we're looking at in our program are people who are dually eligible, meaning Medicare, Medicaid. It's 82% of them. The ones who are not Medicare eligible are those who are excluded by statute. They didn't contribute to the program. They're immigrants who are not in the Medicare program, etc. All the rest of our population are Medicare, Medicaid, over 55. In our case, our average age is 74, 70% female, about 72% living alone, multiple comorbidities, two-thirds of whom also have vision as a comorbidity. There's one-third who on their diagnoses don't have it, and what we're trying to do is to get exams on them so we can bolster that sample and make it look like what it really is, because we're not finding a data set that has good vision data with good healthcare data. And that's where we are, and that's what we're doing. If there are any questions, we're glad to attempt to answer them. Yes?
The question that I have for you, knowing that underreporting occurs at such a high rate, you could make an estimate maybe, or you could survey physicians maybe, but my guess is, like you said, unless it is directly linked to their revenue or their billing, they're not going to bill for it. Could you make some kind of estimate on what proportion, what is the proportion of underreporting so that you could make an estimate of like an error?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Institutionalized and not. Could you then, these are like double and triple estimates. I don't know the accuracy of,
Yeah, you're forcing me to disclose something that I was not going to disclose.
Okay.
I am chairing a commission in New York for our governor. I was asked to chair a group that's looking at this precise thing in New York, and for the first time giving us access to the data that exists in different governmental agencies. That came about because of a presentation I did where I did precisely what you're suggesting and used the study, help me Elizabeth, 2004, that looked at prevalence of vision loss, the authoritative study, and I can't remember the author, Congdon, I think. And we took the age bands and the prevalence that he used, applied it against New York's population, and in a very public and very ugly confrontation with the Commission for the Blind, I asked them how many blind people there were in New York. And they had absolutely no idea. Their guess was ridiculous. And then I took out the slide that had, and they said, well, how did you get that? Where did you get that? And I said, well, I did what precisely you were suggesting, and that's exactly what we're doing. We have to assume that the national data and that study applies to us, and we have to assume that there's nothing in the water in New York that immunizes one against blindness, so we have the same proportion and the same predominance. And for our visitor from Thailand, that may not be true in your country, but it is in New York. We have the best water in the country in New York. So that's a very, I think, a very reasonable and legitimate way to proceed in the absence of anything else. And we would love to see, I've suggested to hospitals, for example, that they're missing inpatient revenue when a person comes in for an inpatient procedure, under New York statute, and I believe under federal, they're required to have a overall health assessment. And that overall health assessment covers every body system, save for two things, eyes and ears. Ears would be a little bit more difficult. Eyes would be as simple as behind the nursing station having a simple Snellen chart and say, by the way, would you read the red line, read the green line? And if they can't, that could be a referral for ophthalmology or optometry services within the hospital. They could generate increased revenue. The patient would have better quality of life. They'd be happy with, you know, on and on and on. But they're not doing that. And I'm out of time, and thank you for pointing that out. And for those of you in the audience who did not have a chance to ask questions, if you email them in, we'll... It will save doctor time. If you think about this, I mean, something as simple as a Snellen on the wall behind the counter where you're filling out the forms and you're asked to get a clipboard with all the things to fill out, your medical insurance ID card and all that stuff, and they ask you to read that and they find out that you can't read it. From that, we know a couple things are going to happen. Number one is you really do need eye services. Maybe something as simple as a pair of glasses, maybe something as involved as macular degen or cataracts or glaucoma or diabetic retinopathy or something else. But you ought to get checked. The second thing we know is based on our 99 study, if you have vision loss, you're going to stay in the hospital longer.
That would be an excellent
study. All right. So we've suggested that, and we've actually talked with the Foundation of New York and the United Hospital Fund about doing that, and we're now that we're partnered with Columbia on a number of projects, we might possibly do that. They think it's pretty simplistic, and they think they're much more sophisticated than that, and they think that there are many, many more reasons why people stay in the hospital longer, and we think it's not quite that difficult.